Mighty most death.
It's simple mathematics.
Check it out.
I revolve around science.
What are we talking about here?
Mathematics.
You are listening to Relatos Zapatista on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1. And that last song was a song by Mos Def, entitled Mathematics. And at any point during the show, we're going till 6 o'clock. Feel free to call in with any questions or additions to our show. The number is 510-495-1666. And so our next segment is actually going to be dealing with the recent kind of events and context of the drug war going on in Mexico. So in the studio today, we have our friend and comrade, John Gibler. And John Gibler recently has published, let's see, two books, one in 09, titled Mexico Unconquered, The Chronicles of Power and Revolt. And then also very recently, about a month ago, he published another book, To Die in Mexico, Dispatches from Inside the Drug War. So we want to thank you for coming on to our show. And I want to catch the audience up just a little bit to lead into this interview. The past couple of shows, we've talked and we've documented the letters between Luis Villoro and Marcos. And these letters have kind of came out after a mobilization in May, where Juan Cecilia, poet, and thousands of people marched to the Zocalo to protest the government's kind of incapacity of dealing with the drug war. In those letters, we talked about a lot on the show and referenced the letters in the sense of the effect of the kind of decomposition of the social fabric in Mexico. So I wanted you to start off, kind of, if you could state a working definition of the drug war and then talk about the effect of the social fabric of the people of Mexico, the families, and the communities. A big question, but...
Indeed, a big question. I'll try to jump in. I would say this needs a lot of unpacking analysis, will seem like an oversimplification, but in effect, the drug war over the past four decades since redeclared by Nixon in 1971 has been a proxy war for racism and imperialism, social control. That has been the impact of the drug war. There has been no effective intervention in the levels of narcotics produced, the levels shipped transnationally, nor consumed in the United States. There are more people now consuming drugs than at any point ever before. In that sense, the so-called war on drugs has been a failure. The drug industry right now is huge and booming, stays steady when other sectors, especially of speculative capitalism, crashed in 2008. The United Nations estimates that the drug industry worldwide generates between 350 and 500 billion U.S. dollars a year. It's a thriving industry. So in any kind of economic sense, the drug war, if it were meant to prohibit these substances, their sales and distribution, has been a colossal failure. But what we have seen is in the United States of America, the creation of the largest prison population in the world, the largest per capita prison population in the world, largely people of colors, that was created through the vehicle of the drug war, the criminalization of an underclass through the criminalization of minor possession and sales of these substances. Again, a war largely waged against people of color. The lawyer and writer Michelle Alexander recently published a book called The New Jim Crow, where she documents this very process of how the drug war became the reconfiguration of Jim Crow segregation policies and legalized discrimination against people of color, largely African Americans. So if there were any kind of a war against these substances, their sales, their distribution, their consumption, that war would have been a colossal failure. But I don't think that rate of failure is realistic. What's more realistic is an astounding rate of success, where the success is a drug war used as a kind of proxy war for intervention, United States imperialist intervention in the Americas, and the use of racialized forms of social control in the United States. That said, what have been the impacts on the social fabric in Mexico over these last 4.5 years of an explicit militarized strategy of a so-called drug war waged by Felipe Calderón? The two key facts of these past 4.5 years are murder and impunity. in the last 4.5 years, more than 41,000 people have been executed in Mexico. And according to government, Mexican federal government statistics, 95% of those murders have not even been investigated. So we're talking about a guaranteed impunity rate of 95% for the crime of murder, for these killings and executions. Impunity, again, just to be understood, means that the crimes go unpunished, or that the murders go unpunished. People are killed. There's no investigation, and there's no accountability for the act of murder. What that has done socially has been install a regime of fear and terror. The numbers do violence themselves. I think it's important to anchor a discussion in these kind of statistics because they give us scale of a problem, but then we have to interrogate the statistics themselves to see all the kinds of other forms of violence that are hidden or packed underneath them. So 41,000 people executed in impunity means 82,000 parents whose children were murdered, means hundreds of thousands of relatives and friends who lost their loved ones. It also means hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people who live in a place where murder goes unpunished, where it's now normal to, in the course of a childhood, to see dead bodies on the street and to know nothing will happen, to see bodies hanging from bridges, decapitated bodies thrown out in parks or city streets. That level of violence has, and again, always the violence coupled with impunity, the fact that nothing happens afterwards, that there's no institutional or community response to the scale of murder, means that it becomes normalized. It becomes everyday. People become desensitized, which on the first hand serves the state to cover up all other forms of political violence. There's been outrageous cases, as I know you guys have documented here on the show, of political assassination and violence conducted that has been entirely buried by this drug war. We were just speaking here at the station earlier today about the killings of human rights activists in Oaxaca as they were in a caravan riding out to San Juan Copala. That in April 2010, that would have been a huge international news story 10 years ago, and it was barely a blip on the AP newswire because it took place in the scale of, you know, a few months before. In January 2010, 17 teenagers were gunned down at a house party in absolute impunity in Ciudad Juarez. A few months later, in August, 72 migrants were executed, slain in a barn in San Fernando, Tamaulipas. So in that scale of absolute, incredible violence, political violence, the assassination of indigenous rights activists, anti-mining activists, human rights activists, community mobilizing forces is completely buried or lost. And that also is part of this very intensely destructive impact of this violence and impunity in the social fabric, is that people get used to seeing this level of violence and all other forms of state violence get kind of washed into and obscured in the logic of drug war execution.
You talked a little bit about the relationship, I mean, the idea of the drug war as a success as opposed to a failure. And, you know, the question is, what is it being successful at? And I think that one of the ways that people conventionally talk about the drug war is as a war between these two very coherent sides, the state on the one hand, sort of composed of the army and, you know, the police. And on the other hand, the drug traffickers or the cartels. And one of the things that we've been sort of trying to do a little bit, you know, tentatively, is follow the line that people like Subcomandante Marcos and the Zapatistas have sort of outlined or begun to outline in their public statements about the fact that, and other people, you know, of course, you included, have begun to outline the argument that, in fact, it's really difficult, if not impossible, to talk about two separate sides in this drug war. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit more concretely about the ways that the cartels and the drug traffickers are actually part of the state, so intertwined as to make it impossible to separate them analytically. So maybe like sort of talk a little bit theoretically or at an abstract level, and then maybe also give a couple of really concrete examples about how that's the case.
Absolutely. I think that's a key essential point, this myth that there are cops and robbers, good guys and bad, two distinct sides, that if every once in a while they overlap, we can explain that with the idea of corruption, right? That there's an otherwise good entity, the police, but there are a few bad apples inside that corrupt them, and they can be eliminated, go to jail, and everything returns to normalcy of cops, good guys, robbers, bad guys. That is entirely empathetically false. On an abstract level, recall, drugs are a major transnational industry to the tune of between $350 and $500 billion a year. It's a huge global industry. The industry happens to be illegal. So illegality structures the commodity form, and it also structures the marketplace. It's one of the key features of this industry. Whereas with books, one of the key features is the physical weight of books. The physical weight of books creates the largest expense in the publishing industry, which is shipping. So for drugs, illegality creates the largest expense for the industry, which is shipping without people noticing, right? Shipping across borders without record of things being shipped across borders. Consider, in the United States of America, a vast territory, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamines, marijuana are available in every city in this country. That is an incredible complex distribution network. What else is available in every city of the country? Well, things like Coca-Cola, Marlboro, Camels, right? What is not available in every city in this country? Left-wing books, like independent bookstores don't exist in every city in this country. And yet drugs can be found in pretty much every city in this country. So again, the fact of an incredible complex distribution network on an industrial scale. And where illegality, like remaining invisible to society at large, the press, and the state itself, is an essential feature of the industry. The only way that that is possible is to have employees directly working in the industry inside the state. There is no other way. You can't have this level of distribution, this success of distribution of a commodity on a global scale that's illegal, if you don't have employees inside the state doing the bidding of getting the products across the borders without being officially seen. So that's kind of on an abstract level. There's really no way to have this scale of industrial activity of the production, shipping, and distribution and sales of these illegal commodities, narcotics and drugs, without employees on every level of the state. So in a kind of concrete level, if you follow the news headlines, there's almost every couple of weeks you'll see a blip in the news wires of a customs officials on the border, a border patrol official, a sheriff in a border town, a beat cop in a border town who gets caught with a little too many color TVs in their apartment, or one too many, you know, Yukon SUVs or something like that. They stumble upon the closet filled with cash. And again, that's easily then dealt with in the media, and the kind of drug war ideology is corruption. Like, oh, the cartels are too powerful because of the cash they have, and they corrupt easily.
Just to be clear, are we talking about people on the U.S. side of the border, or on the Mexico side of the border, or both?
Well, right there, we're talking about, I was concretely mentioning U.S. agencies, but it's absolutely both sides of the border, and both sides of, or any side of every border. It's a global phenomenon. The United States, of course, likes to export the perception of chaos and export the perception of corruption to other countries, right? So Colombia is the dark evil country, or Mexico is the dark evil country where people fall to the seductions of corruption. And that is, of course, entirely bogus, and that's what a kind of world systems analysis, if you will, of the drug trade enables us to see, that it's not like any one country is more prone to so-called corruption. No, the structure of this global commodity chain that's illegal is such that there have to be employees working in the industry in every government. It's the only way for this stuff to get across the borders. Otherwise, you know, it wouldn't get across the borders. The borders with the agencies that are tasked with stopping the flow of these commodities would do their jobs. The commodities would be stopped and people would stop consuming them, and, you know, the drug war would have been won. But of course, that is an entirely fantastical, speculative creation. They're the simple fact of four decades of the drug wars, there are more drugs moved across global borders and consumed across the world than any time before. So in Mexico, concretely, direct participation in the trade is rampant. We know that the municipal police, just using here even just government statistics, the federal government released a report a year and a half ago saying that they suspected that they said drug cartels have penetrated more than 50% of the municipal police. That's what the federal government told you, right? So if the federal government's owning up to at least half the municipal police forces in the country being directly involved in the trade, that's kind of devastating. There was a report written in Harper's Magazine a year and a half or 2 years ago by Charles Bowden, where he did this interview with a Mexican hitman. It's now been published as a book called El Sicario, or The Sicario. Many things that one could go on a tangent talking about Bowden and his work. But if we take that as legitimate, he really interviewed this hitman and the hitman's really telling the truth. What for me was one of the most valuable pieces of that interview was where the hitman talks about how he was first enrolled in the Chihuahua State Police Forces and he was recruited from the police force into the cartel structure. And he talked about how the police force was, in fact, the principal recruitment center for gunslingers at the employ of the transnational narcotics industry, in this case, the Juarez cartel or the Sinaloa cartel or one of these organizations. There's the example of the Zetas. The Zetas were a special forces commando force created during Ernesto Zedillo's administration of 1994 to 2000, which were tasked with largely interrupting and disarticulating the so-called Gulf cartel. Well, the then leader of the Gulf cartel, Ociel Cárdenas, purchased that entire commando elite force. At the, about 30 of the members, they all defected en masse and created the paramilitary, drug elite force now known as Los Zetas. They were entirely formed, created, trained by the United States, by Israeli commandos, by the Guatemalan counterinsurgency, Kaibil school. I mean, they were, and that's a key analysis point here, is that the legacy of counterinsurgency and its relation to the drug trafficking industry, I think, is in the example of Los Zetas clearly embodied. All of the knowledge, the techniques, the training and torture and execution and firing assault rifles from high-speed automobiles, all of that actual tactical knowledge that came from the death squads in the 1970s, 1980s, the counterinsurgency movements in Latin America, is now directly at the root and the service and the employ of the drug trafficking organizations, embodied very concretely in the group Los Zetas.
In your book, you mentioned a few more statistics about right when Calderon came president, he actually arrested a couple of mayors and a couple of other government officials. Could you briefly just recite that?
Absolutely. That was in 2009, right before the midterm elections in Mexico, the federal police stormed the state of Michoacán, the city of Morelia, the capital, and arrested more than 30 government officials, elected officials, police officers, judges, city council members, all members of the PRD, the opposition PRD party, and charged with drug trafficking. In the Mexican press, they called it El Michoacanazo, right? It was right before the midterm elections and served to create this perception, A, of the Calderon administration, cracking down on corruption, so to say, and B, of the PRD being intensely involved in drug trafficking in Michoacan. Michoacan being Calderon's home state, by the way. Well, fast forward 2 years later, and all those cases were dropped. All those people were released. There were no charges that could stick. It was an entirely media creation with electoral intent, right? It was right before the midterm elections to give a boost to the right-wing PAN party against the so-called or center-ish left party of the PRD. They arrested en masse all these PRD officials without having done any kind of actual investigation having any evidence against them. A year and a half later, they were all released. Now here, it's interesting to follow along the U.S. press coverage, because the majority of the United States press is a major story you know, Calderon cracks down on corrupt officials. It was in all the headlines in the New York Times and all these papers. But a year and a half later, nobody was reporting really in the U.S. press on the fact that little by little, one by one, they're all being released. There's one exception. It should be mentioned. William Booth at the Washington Post wrote a very good story when there were only like two or three of them left in jail saying, hey, what happened? You know, and William Booth is one of the rare cases, I think, of the kind of mainstream U.S. journalist who's done some important reporting on the drug war. And that was a good piece that he put out. But here we're talking about what was a huge national media event, the detention of all these people. But there was just one, you know, pretty good news story that came out a year and a half later saying, wait, where are they now? Look, what's happened? What's the follow-up? And that shows how the drug war, as it's conceived and waged by the government, is largely a media phenomenon. And indeed, in the book, I interview the subdirector, one of the main editors of the newspaper in Ciudad Juárez, El Diario, who said to me, he said, you know, the government doesn't perceive events when they happen. They perceive them when they're published in the press. If the New York Times or El País writes an article, then the government reacts. When it happens, they didn't react. But when the New York Times or El País writes about it, then they react. But their reaction is not aimed toward addressing what happened in society. It's aimed towards addressing what the New York Times or the El País reporters wrote about. And so it's entirely a media strategy and a media campaign instead of actually any kind of like social content.
So with that, talking about media, I wanted to, in your book, you're interviewing someone and they ask you, you know, how do you cover the drug war in an authentic way, or how do you cover it well? And they state that instead of just counting the dead or, you know, looking at the fear that's caused, actually, like, hear the stories of the living. And I just wanted you to talk a little bit about what you think the role of an outside journalist is in the sense of covering such a severe situation, such as the drug war.
Indeed. Well, personally, I was in Mexico, still reporting on issues like migration, military abuse, as well as uprising and social mobilizations in 2008, and having watched throughout 2007 the violence related to the drug industry just explode and in direct relation to Calderon's strategy. And to be quite honest, I was at a bar in Mexico City with a bunch of friends, Mexican reporters, and we were talking about the madness. And I said, you know, I really feel like as an alternative press reporter from the United States, I have to start reporting on this because its impact socially is so devastating, it seemed like it would be irresponsible to ignore it. But what could I contribute, you know, that the Mexican reporters who are already doing an excellent job and under really intense conditions aren't already doing? I don't want to simply repeat, and I don't want to be one of these vampires who just comes and sucks the blood of good Mexican reporting and then try and take the credit for it. And we were just kind of talking about all these ideas. And then it dawned on me, I was like, oh, wait, I should write about you guys. Like, I should write about the reporters. That's something that's original that I can contribute. You guys are simply doing it, and you're living your lives. But I, as an outsider, might see things about the way you're engaging this world that is interesting and of value. And indeed, I wanted to write about and report on the drug war that in a way that didn't follow the traditional lines of talking to cops and robbers, so to speak, right? Just talking to police or seeking out the, you know, the hitmen, killers, and getting the sensationalist interview. That's not to say that valuable information doesn't come from those interviews. It can. But that was being done. I wanted to try and do something different, and I wanted to take a side view in, so to speak. And one of the ways I did that was to seek out Mexican reporters working in the front lines for the local media, because it's very different. Even in Mexico, if you're working at a national media outlet based in Mexico City and flying in and out of Culiacán, Matamoros, Ciudad Juárez, it's very, very intense, but it's still very different than the people who were born and raised, live, raise their families, and publish all in the same city. Those are the people who carry an intense amount of risk. And if you look at the long, now horribly sad list of Mexican journalists who have been executed in the past 4 years, more than 60 since I think 2000, they're largely reporters, almost entirely reporters, who live and report and publish all in the same city. And so I wanted to go ride along with them, interview them at length, and kind of try and perceive this entire problem and world through their stories and their lives.
We're going to go to a musical break real quick, and then we will come back and finish up our interview with John Gibler, talking about the drug war currently going on in Mexico.
Medina Green. Medina Green. DCQ. The mighty Mo. Can't forget. Never day. Tell him.
4 a.m. laid up at the rest. Got a call, made my heart jump out my chest. My man's got beef at the dance, exits his block. Enemies outside with a heat on cop. He said that if he goes outside, he know he's gonna get clapped.
My man from way back
ain't going out like that. He got peoples in the club and the ties is strong, but he know that they can only hold it down for so long. So now he's trapped off and he's calling on me to come and represent like I'm G-O-D. Of course I must agree, cause this is family. If tables was turned, he would do it for me. So now I'm hopping out my bed, ready to put a nigga never seen phone dead. Guess a black man can't have no peace. Pull out my heat, woke up out my sleep over Crosstown beef.
Crosstown beef be like Crosstown traffic. Brothers be on some real shit. Every man is scared when we're prepared for conversation.
When the slugs penetrate, you feel a burning sensation.
Crosstown beef be like Crosstown traffic. Brothers be on some real shit. Every man is scared when we're prepared for conversation.
Getting closer to God in a tight situation.
It was a Friday in the month of May, around the time when everybody put their game on play. See, my girl was out of G, so it was all on me. I figured I would hit the metro on the Matt LD. Now everybody know what the springtime is about. Players polish up their game, cause the shorty be out. I was rocking jewels and my wares was crisp. My man said it was a jam that I should not miss. I hopped in delivery without a moment to spare. And when I pulled up on the function, everybody was there. I was catching sexy stares from the shams in the rear. I saw my peers and heads I hadn't seen in years. And I was getting caught up in the nightlight mix. That's when I see my main man from my old time clique. Oh shit, now my nigga Mos Def in the house. Oh shit, baby Paul, I ain't know you came home. We talked about that and this and way back since. This when I seen a caravan sporting wild dog tents. Had its windows half cracked and was cruising slow. And was circling the block like they was po-po. Then I was jibbing with my man, so I paid it no mind. That's when the shots rang out from the passenger side. It was a 45 vault that made us all duck down. Girls was letting out screams and shells hit the ground. I was looking for my man, so we both were split. That's when he turned to me and said, yo, Mos, I'm hit. I guess the street lights don't leave a nigga alone. Laced up at the party and he just came home. If he survived, I know he gon' retaliate. If he don't, they bought themselves a burial place. Either way, situation status on cold red. I'm on the horn to tell a fam it's on like Corn Ed. Crosstown beef be like Crosstown traffic. Brothers be on some real shit. Every man gets scared when prepared for conversation.
When the slums penetrate, you feel a burning sensation.
Crosstown beef be like Crosstown traffic.
Hey yo, son, get that?
Say it, man, you sitting right there.
Oh, come on, man, what's this right now?
Say it, man, with the laziness. What up, man?
Come on, man, get the phone, man.
Yeah. Who this? Who? What's the big phone?
Hey. Who this?
The guard too.
Yo, what up, son?
Nothing much, maintaining you.
Right.
I just came out the bing and shit is mad real. This shit ain't about nothing, son.
Son, I know how you feel.
My girl is in the world trying to raise my seed. It's mad shit that she want and mad shit that she need. Right. Plus she got some nigga.
All right, you are back listening to Relatos Zapatistas on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1. And we're currently in the middle of an interview with our compa and friend John Gibler. And so we're in the middle of an interview where we're looking at the context of the drug war that was called to fruition about 4.5 years ago, in which about 41,000 people have been executed in Mexico. And so we've talked a lot about how the relationship between the cartels and the state, impunity, and also the role of journalists covering it. But we have yet to talk about the people's response to the situation that they're currently in. So real quick, just to narrate a little bit of a history. In early April of this year, we saw the emergence of an opposition to the drug war that culminated in a massive march in the Zocalo, or DFA, on May 8th, led by poet and public intellectual Javier Cecilia, who just about 6 weeks before that, his son had been executed by a cartel. And in conjunction with this, the Zapatista movement down in San Cristobal de las Casas had a silent march in solidarity with the march on May 8th. And then in June, inspired from the march on DF, there was a peace caravan that was against the drug war. So if you could talk a little bit about the significance of this movement and how this movement may be a little bit different than the marches or movements that we've seen in the past. And is it effective in the sense, or how is it being effective? And then also what's currently going on with kind of confronting not only the government, but the war on drugs.
Absolutely. I think first it's important to recall that there have been marches and mobilizations against the drug war in places like Culiacan and Ciudad Juarez, but they did not receive a lot of media attention, and they were largely very, very small, or mostly they were small. In the book, I profile a woman named Alma Trinidad, whose son was killed in a massacre at a mechanic shop, and she took to the streets, and she protested, and she spoke out in the media, and she called marches and really creative and intense actions in Culiacan. But they would maybe draw a couple of hundred people, and no one in the national media in Mexico or the international media really turned to pay much attention. Similar things happened in Ciudad Juarez. With Javier Cecilia, things were different because he was famous. He was a poet, or he is famous. He is a poet. And when his son was killed, the national media flocked to him to get a response. And a lot of that is the result of a classist media structure that, you know, ignored the parents of a lot of the working class people who had been executed, and never sought them out, but sought out this poet of, you know, middle class intellectual. But to Javier Cecilia's intense credit, he didn't respond in a simply in a personal way, but he responded in a deeply social way by constantly referencing not only the impunity and outrage at his son's murder, but the outrage at the impunity in all of the murders that have taken place and the pain a nation feels in response to all of this violence and impunity. So as a result of Javier's calls for mobilizations, first locally in Cuernavaca and Morelos State, and then on Mexico City, and then, as you mentioned, the caravan to Ciudad Juarez. It has been incredibly impactful in completely recasting the debate around the drug war in Mexico. For the first time, it is now a mainstream position to even debate legalization, or talk about legalization as one potential strategy. And it's these are the largest mobilizations, I think, in definitely the largest mobilizations in Mexican history, perhaps the largest mobilizations in the Americas, explicitly against the United States militarized drug war, and the entire ideology of a drug war and kind of moralistic prohibition. And to give a scale of the power, only about 2 weeks ago, Javier Cecilia and, well, first, sorry, President Felipe Calderón invited Javier Cecilia to speak. And Cecilia said, okay, but only if it's in public. There's full media access, and I'm not the only representative of family members who have lost, or families who have lost loved ones, or representative from civil society organizations. Finally, after a lot of back and forth, Calderón agreed, and the president, his wife, the federal attorney general, the secretary of government, which is kind of like Mexico's vice president, really the second most powerful position in Mexican government, all sat in a room in Mexico City in the Chapultepec Castle, and engaged in a public televised conversation with Javier Cecilia and other representatives of the social movement. That is, I mean, it's a very problematic event on a number of levels, but one thing that it is it an incredible testament to the power of this movement. They brought, on their terms, saying in public, full media, and like none of this backroom stuff, none of us going to the president's chambers or, you know, a congressional chambers. No. In public, full media access, full broadcast No blackouts, like full broadcast of everything that was said. Everything that was said on the air in front of millions of people. And you had Calderon, sitting there listening, as Javier Cecilia said, you and your misguided militarization strategy are responsible for more than 40,000 deaths. You must apologize. You must change strategies. That was said before a nation. You know, I mean, it was a very empowering event. Although, you know, since then, Calderon also, of course, tried to use the event to completely, create an image of the listening president and the president who really cares about what people think and feel. And he got up and hugged the mother of a young man who'd been killed as she broke down crying during her testimony. And at the end, now kind of infamously, of the event, he went up and hugged Javier Cecilia. And now Javier Cecilia has been completely slammed and attacked in the media by the left for hugging Calderon, as if that were what were important, instead of like standing up to, you know, the state and calling the state out on its strategies of, you know, mass execution and criminalization of working class, especially youth. So this so-called dialogue event or public discussion between members of civil society and the Calderon administration, for me, is in an empowering sense a testimony of the power of these voices and their reason. Like, they brought this administration into a terrain that they largely defined. It's also problematic, and it's totally worthy of constructive criticism about, like, you know, when is it good and empowering to engage in that kind of direct conversation with the state? And what ways do movements need to be careful to not fall into traps, not become co-opted? But I do think we should give Cecilia credit as an individual, and then also a lot of the people involved in the movement, for being aware of those traps and trying, I think, very good, sincere efforts to not fall into them. So where things stand right now is there was a 3-month period supposedly for the government to analyze critiques brought forth, and they were potentially going to go into another dialogue, but who knows if that will happen because of the fallout. Cecilia, after the meeting, excoriated Calderon, completely tore him apart with analysis of how belligerent he was and how he simply refused to actually listen, even though he made a great theater of listening by, like, getting up and trying to hug people.
So the last question we want to ask in about 5 minutes is, we've been covering the mobilization of the Zapatistas around this issue for the past 2 shows now, and if you could talk just a little bit about the difference that you see between, you know, the large scale mass mobilizations upon DF and then the somewhat silent mobilization of the Zapatistas, just the distinctions between the two.
Well, first off, my first reflection there is I thought it was really empowering to see the Zapatistas respond to and support a call for mobilization that came from another sector of society. The Zapatistas usually are the ones making the calls that Mexican and international or global civil society responds to. And there have been, you know, key moments in the last 15, now 17, 18 years of Zapatista struggle when other struggles, issues, famously the strike in the National Autonomous University of Mexico City, the UNAM, where the Zapatistas have written letters of support. But this, to my knowledge, is the first time that they responded to another call and took to the streets in support and participation of that call, which I think was an incredibly empowering statement and act, and shows, you know, the extent to which the Zapatistas are attentive to watching and trying to, in their way and in their location, participate in these calls for protest. You know, something that's interesting is that, you know, as the nation is completely brutalized by this climate of murder and impunity, to my knowledge, the Zapatista territories have not suffered a single execution in the past 4.5 years, or to my knowledge, in the past 20-something years of Zapatista organizing there, which is something really interesting for analysis in regions of the country where there's incredibly well-constructed, intense, grassroots autonomous social organization, the drug cartels simply haven't gone. There are regions, it's not entirely rosy, there are regions of the country, for example, in the state of Guerrero, where organizations with, that have conducted outreach into different areas to organize have been directly targeted by the narcos and the paramilitary. Famously, the ERPI commander Ramiro was executed by narco paramilitaries in fall of 2009. And there's been a widespread wave of kind of constant paramilitary violence in that region. But in the Zapatista region, there really hasn't been. In the region of the Policía Comunitaria in Guerrero State, there hasn't been that level of violence. But the Zapatistas, are attentive to what's happening to Mexico as a society and Mexico as like a broad and complex multiplicitous community. And even if their territories haven't been targeted by the drug trafficking industry and the cartels, the pain of what's happening to society, Mexican society as a whole, is something that definitely affects them. And thus, that's kind of how I read their call to take to the streets in that gesture of direct participation and community alliance with the call that came from a different location, Cuernavaca, and a different sector of society.
We thank you for coming on to our show and your analysis and your amazing work as a journalist. For those folks who are interested in picking up John Gibler's recent book, To Die in Mexico, you can pick it up pretty much anywhere on the internet, but it's published by City Lights. And if you can, please hit up City Lights to give them some needed resources and support our local independent bookstore. With that, we're going to go to musical break, and then we will come back to finish up the show.
On one hand, you're saying the United States government is spending millions of dollars to eliminate the flow of drugs onto our streets. At the same time, we are doing business with the very same government that is flooding our streets with cocaine.
Mm-hmm. See. Let me show you a few of the other characters that are involved in this tragic comedy.
I'm on the border of Bolivia, working for pennies, treated like a slave. The coca fields have to be ready. The spirit of my people is starving, broken and sweaty, dreaming about revolution, looking at my machete. But the world